Well, this morning we continue our series entitled All About Jesus, and our sermon title is, and it's up there on the screen for you, Jesus in His Father's House. That comes from verse 49 of our passage. And this, it features the story of when Mary and Joseph thought they'd lost Jesus. Now, so far in our studies from Luke, we've only seen Jesus pictured as a baby. We've looked at when his birth was foretold. We've looked at when his birth was announced. And in between these events, we've also heard from Mary, Elizabeth, and Zechariah. Then last week, we saw how baby Jesus was presented to the Lord at the temple. And this morning, we continue his story. However, Luke has kind of moved us on now 12 years. And we can learn that from the opening couple of verses in our text. Look there at verse 42. When he was 12 years old, they went up to the feast according to the custom. Now, this may come as a surprise, jumping from baby to a boy now 12 years old. Yet it's Luke is the only one to record this event. Elsewhere in the Bible, we read about the birth of Jesus and then suddenly he's 30 years old. So why was Luke the only one to record this event from Jesus' childhood? Why was this event significant to Luke, but not perhaps the other gospel writers? Now, I guess there's probably many feasible answers, but let me share just maybe one of them with you. These gospel writers, I guess, were not writing a biographical account of Jesus. Instead, they were writing about redemption, telling us of what Christ had done. Perhaps they didn't want to distract from what Christ had done on their behalf. But to Luke, this event is significant, and therefore, he included it in his account. And we already know, don't we, from right back when we introduced this series, when Phil stood here and introduced it, that Luke's account is more detailed. And this story tells us so. We read this story in Luke because it shows us that Jesus knew who he was. By the age of 12, Jesus had come to fully realize that he was the Son of God. Whilst we know very little about Jesus' early life, from baby through to boy, what we do know is told to us in the verse immediately before our passage. Look back there at verse 40. It tells us that Jesus grew, became strong, and was filled with wisdom. Through the grace of God, which was upon him, Jesus developed spiritually. Now, I'm sure, too, that both Mary and Joseph would have shared the story of his birth. I've no doubt that Jesus was aware of who he was and what lay ahead of him. Now, we learn here in verse 41 that his parents went every year to Jerusalem. Every year, without fail, Mary and Joseph attended the Feast of Passover. In Exodus 23, verse 17, and then in Deuteronomy 16, 16, attendance is commanded. It reads, three times a year, all the men are to appear before the Sovereign Lord. It was customary for the faithful of Galilee to make these pilgrimages together. Therefore, I think it's safe to assume that Jesus would have traveled with them on these visits. Now, I'm sure during these visits, Jesus witnessed these Passover events. And on this particular occasion, he'd have gone with Joseph into the temple. Why doesn't it say that? Whilst it doesn't say that in our text, I think it's safe to assume that the age of Jesus here is really significant. When a Jewish boy reaches 12, they're considered to be under the law. They become a Jewish adult. And therefore, they're responsible for their own actions. This is usually marked by a coming-of-age ceremony. We might know it as a bar mitzvah. It appears to me that this is the visit that's recorded for us in Luke's account. And it's this visit when Jesus came to the temple that he must have put everything together. So turn back to the text with me and consider our first point this morning, losing Jesus. Look at verses 43 to 45. After the feast was over, whilst his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but they were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they travelled on for a day. Then they began looking for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. You know, so we learn from this opening verse that the feast of the Passover was complete. The 7 days were over. It was time for Mary and Joseph to return home. And as Mary and Joseph headed for Nazareth, Jesus remained behind in Jerusalem. So, what's the problem? Well, Mary and Joseph weren't aware. They had no idea that they'd left Jesus behind in the city. Now, it might be hard to understand how you could leave the city without him. Worse still, it's even harder to imagine how you'd miss him for an entire day. But that did happen, and it happens. You only have to ask a certain Simon that we all know. But you know what? In fairness to Simon, you could also have asked my grandfather had he been alive today. You see, my grandfather has a story to tell about a missing person. When I was growing up, my granny injured herself by falling out of the dining hall onto the patio. Her injuries were so severe that she was hospitalized for some time. And after leaving hospital, she returned home with her leg permanently bandaged. For several months or more, she had to travel in the back of their car. This was so she could keep her leg stretched out upon the back seat. And because it was her left leg, the left leg that was damaged, she had to sit behind the driver. Now, most of you know that my grandfather was a minister, and as such, he was called upon on various different preaching arrangements. On one particular occasion, back in August 1988, they headed north together. And after travelling for some while, my grandfather needed a bathroom break. So they stopped at some service station and parked the car. My grandfather then asked my granny if she needed to go too. She replied no and just remained in the car. Anyway, several minutes passed, and while she was waiting, she had a change of heart and decided that she'd better go as well. So she left the car and went into the service station. And shortly afterwards, my grandfather returned to the car, and upon arriving back, he belted up and got straight out on the road. Having travelled for 40 miles, he asked my granny for a mint. In doing so, he held out his hand in anticipation of receiving the said mint. Imagine the shock when the mint didn't arrive. Imagine the greater shock when he looked in the mirror and Granny was not in the back of the car. She was nowhere to be seen. Now, whilst all this was going on, Granny, of course, did try and return to the car. And she came out of the service station, arrived back at the car, but it was no longer in the said parking bay. Worse still, there was no sign of my grandfather anywhere at the services. So she went back inside and informed the police. They then contacted my father, who was surprised to receive a call which said basically, "Excuse me, sir, but are you the son of the Right Reverend Roland Lamb?" My father replied, "Yes." And the police officer said, "Well, it appears that the Right Honourable Reverend has left his wife." Well, my father was able to inform the police of their destination, and without any further delay, they set off with Granny in the back of the police car, blue lights flashing. They eventually caught up, they raced up the motorway, and they flagged my grandfather down. And needless to say, my grandfather was extremely disappointed and embarrassed, and would be equally so if he knew I was telling this story. Anyway, they were finally reunited, and they could go on their way. And my grandfather had really hoped they'd got away with the whole situation. However, the next morning, the account was recorded in the Daily Express newspaper. And worse still, some months later, my grandparents, were hosting lunch. They were hosting another minister and his wife for Sunday dinner. And during the lunch, the minister begins to retell this story about he had read about this reverend who had left his wife stranded at a service station. Imagine the surprise when my grandfather said, "Well, that was me." You see, these things happen. These things happen and are likely to happen when traveling in big groups. It happened in a couple here. And with respect to Mary and Joseph, they were traveling in a large group, a group made up of family and friends and with neighbours from Nazareth. And because the roads were largely unsafe, people travelled together in big groups for safety. And when in a large group, it's not uncommon for children and families to mix up. You know, we saw that yesterday when the children on the family walk all came together. However, we need to recognise the timing again. The timing and the age of Jesus. It's certainly likely that on the way, Jesus was with the children. He'd have travelled to Jerusalem with Mary and the other women and children. But on the way back, he should have travelled with Joseph and the men. Since having now come of age, he was considered a responsible adult male. Make no mistake, Jesus should have been under the care of his father, Joseph. But he wasn't, and as evening fell on that day, they realized that Jesus was missing. So upon learning this, they began to look for him amongst friends and relatives. Whilst we aren't told this, you could probably imagine the panic that had begun to set in. Most parents will understand the feeling of panic when you can't find your child. You know, I wonder if that feeling is even greater, knowing that this was Jesus, this was God's son. Now that's some story to tell. Imagine having to explain that you'd lost Jesus. And after not finding him in the group, Mary and Joseph then headed back to Jerusalem. Can you imagine those discussions as they walked back to Jerusalem to find him? Just for a little context, Nazareth was roughly 100 miles or so from Jerusalem. I think earlier in this series we spoke about it being the distance of walking from here to the Blackpool Tower, something along those lines. They'd already travelled a day, so imagine they must have clocked up maybe 20 miles or more. That's a decent amount of time to be discussing where Jesus had gone. "Well, I thought he was with you." "No way, I was pretty sure he was with you." Remember though, Jesus should have travelled with Joseph and the men. But this wasn't the time for pointing fingers or placing the blame. Where do you think he's gone? Where will he sleep? Did he realise we had gone? It must have been a challenging time for both Mary and Joseph. Just picture it for a moment. But as we move into verse 46, we read that Mary and Joseph find Jesus. That leads us nicely onto the second point this morning, finding Jesus. Look what it says there in verses 46 to 52. After 3 days, they found him in the temple court, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." Why were you searching for me?" he asked. "Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Then he went back down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. Mary and Joseph find Jesus in the temple court after 3 days. Why 3 days? Well, some conjecture here. One day leaving Jerusalem. 1 day returning, looking for Jesus in Jerusalem. And then the third day, finding Jesus. And what a relief when they find him. But when they eventually find Jesus, what is he doing? Well, we read he's sitting among the teachers, he's listening to them, he's asking questions. You know, for me, that's astonishing in itself. He's not looking for his parents, he's not frantic. Instead, he's just listening to the teachers and soaking up everything they say. Look there at verse 47. Look how everyone reacts to him. It reads, "Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers." The use of the word amazed is significant here. They were astonished by Jesus. They were astonished by questions Jesus asked and the insight he possessed. What sort of questions did Jesus ask? Were they to instruct or for information? We don't know the answer to this, but we do know he surprised those there. Jesus had a clarity in his thought and an understanding they found amazing. Not only were the people present astonished, but his parents were too. But were Mary and Joseph astonished by his understanding or by his location? Again, we don't know the answer to this, but I suspect it could be the latter. You see, I'm pretty sure that Mary and Joseph would have taught Jesus the scriptures. They knew Jesus was special. They knew he was superior. He had such wisdom. So I'm suggesting that Mary and Joseph were astonished by his location. Look what it says there in verse 48. Why, son, why have you treated us like this? You know, our response to a missing child might be something similar. What are you doing? Why weren't you with us? You gave us a heart attack. And like Mary adds, your father and I have been anxiously searching for you. We've been looking everywhere for you. What have you been doing? You can imagine the anxiety perhaps in her voice, the panic set upon her face. But look how Jesus answers in verse 49. Why were you searching for me? He asked. Didn't you know that I'd be in my father's house? What a fascinating response. Why were you looking all over Jerusalem for me? Where else would I be but in my father's house? Jesus has. Again, even at this young age, Jesus was well aware of who he was and knew exactly who his father was. He was aware of his divine nature. Notice the difference between the two uses of the word father in our text. Mary referred to Joseph as Jesus' father in verse 48, which is appropriate. It's entirely appropriate given their adoptive relationship with Jesus. Joseph was Jesus' earthly father. He provided for both Mary and Joseph. Yet Jesus' reference to his father, capital F, is so much more significant. The temple is the house of God, reference 1 Kings 8, 17 and 20. Jesus identifies God as his father, implying an appreciation of his divine life. These are perhaps the earliest spoken words recorded from Jesus, and they reflect the most important aspect of his identity. In verse 49, note, Jesus is not saying why his parents were looking for him in general. Rather, he suggests the temple is the only place that they should have gone to. It's where they should have expected to find him, where he had naturally head. Jesus knew who he was at 12 years. He was God's unique and special son. But I guess there could be a question that remains unanswered. Did Jesus disobey his parents? Did he disobey his parents by staying behind? Well, there's nothing in the passage that indicates Jesus was disobedient. We don't read that Jesus was told he needed to come home, then refused. Jesus was not being disobedient. He was just wrapped up in the goings on. So wrapped up that he gave no thought to what was happening around him. It's like he's completely oblivious to the time. That's not hard to imagine. Think about the child who's so engrossed in a video game they can't speak. And when they try to speak to them, they don't hear you say anything. Or what about those who are absorbed in a football match or a rugby match? Very rarely does Ruth get anything out of me when I'm watching sport. Although, given how bad Liverpool are playing at the moment, I'm not rushing to watch them. Usually, though, she could ask a host of questions to me and never get a response. And when I do raise a response, there's no chance I've remembered it the following day. I think this is what happened to Jesus. He was immersed in the teaching. He was completely engaged in what he was doing. He was well away. Wouldn't it be great if we or our children became fully absorbed, completely captivated with the Lord, that we or they lost all track of time. Jesus had his priorities right, and we'll return to those before we close. But don't miss what we read in the last couple of verses. They read in verses 51 and 52, "Then he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men." Having seen the anguish of his parents, Jesus obediently went with them. You know, Jesus saw submission as an act of obedience, an act of obedience to his Father in heaven. Whilst he may have wanted to remain in Jerusalem, he didn't want to dishonor his parents or cause them upset. So he obediently went with them. He accompanied them back to Nazareth. But notice how the passage concludes. Notice that final verse there. Luke adds, "Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God." That's very similar to the words that Luke used in verse 40. Do you see that? It's like this episode of Jesus as a boy is sandwiched between these two verses. It's clear that Luke wants us to know that Jesus was growing in wisdom. He was developing in stature and was growing both spiritually and socially. So as we draw to a close this morning, I feel like, Phil, it's about two or three conclusions, so bear with me. As we draw to a close this morning, what can we draw out of the text this morning? Firstly, train your child or children in things of God. This is something Mary and Joseph did, and we should do the same. Every year, Mary and Joseph made the trip to Jerusalem for Passover. And in doing so, they established a pattern of honoring God. Solomon wrote in Proverbs 22, verse 6, "Train a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not turn from it." The Bible is clear. We should actively point our children towards God. This means teaching them to pray, to read the Bible, to seek God. We should guide them towards seeking God's heart in whatever they do. It means training them to worship, to attend Sunday school, to do youth events. It means teaching our children to honor the Lord with their finances. It means teaching them to serve the Lord with their time. Sadly, through my observations, this isn't the common approach today. The common approach now is, let our children decide for themselves. And that poses a distinct problem for us. Why? Because, you know, our television, our music, our secular world, it just promotes ungodliness. You know, when our children are only exposed to one option, we shouldn't be surprised when they choose that option. Some will say, I don't want to fight with my children over church. But may I ask, if you aren't willing to fight for their spiritual well-being, what are you willing to fight for? What are your priorities for them? If you're willing to fight for other things, then what does that say? Doesn't that say something troubling about our own values? Make no mistake, we are training our children in the way they should go. The question is, what way are we training them to go? Are we training them in the knowledge and spiritual truths of God? Are we pointing them to world, or are we pointing them towards the superficial materialism of this world? Parents. And if you think I'm pointing the finger, I'm not, because I'm speaking to myself in this in the same way. Take a good look at your family. If you're promoting ungodliness by your inaction, then change direction. Secondly, make the Lord a priority above everything else. Jesus believed that responsibility to the Lord took priority above everything. Therefore, he wondered why his parents wouldn't know he was in the temple. Jesus is giving us a lesson in priorities here. He's saying God is number one, and he must be the number one priority in our lives too. Now, I'm not saying that activities of the church must be a priority or must take priority, because I guess we can be active in church and still not be making God priority. Serving the Lord is a full-time proposition. There isn't time to take a day off. If we're going to serve the Lord full-time, then he must be a priority. We must give priority to growing our relationship with him. God must be first in our hearts. We must spend time in his word every day. Take time to read and listen to the scriptures and then seek to apply them. Call out to him in prayer. Ask God to help you. Ask him to open your eyes. Pray about the things which concern you. Pray for those who cause you trouble. Pray also for those who are hurting around you. Develop a relationship with God. Dwell on the things of God. Allow your faith to grow and develop in intimacy. And then share this intimacy with the family. Make him a priority of your family. Give thanks to God at the dinner table. Seek God's guidance from the Bible. Pray with each other as a family. Pray in the morning. Pray at the morning and at bedtime, before bedtime, just at bedtime. But pray. Make it known that Sunday is first and foremost a day for the Lord. So it should be obvious that the most important things in life is God. It should be evident that what matters to us in this world is worshipping God. Could these things be said of us? Do the world see that worshipping God is the most important thing? Do they see that serving others for the sake of Jesus is the model of our life? Do they see that studying God's word is our guide to life? Do we communicate to others that God is the most important thing? Do our children see that in our lives? Do we make our children learn that God is the most important? I hope that when people in this world, in this community, look at us here at Homegate, I hope they think that we are always at church. We're always praying. We're always helping others. We're always studying and always serving the Lord. Thirdly and finally, respect those in authority over you. Jesus respected those in authority over him, and so should we. Isn't it fascinating that Jesus submitted to the authority of his parents? One of the things God intended to do in becoming man was to give us an example of what it meant to live a godly life. Submission is not simply about maintaining order in society. It's about developing a pattern that will carry over into our relationship with God. You know, the people who rebel against earthly authority will be the same ones who rebel against God's authority. I guess once we believe we can handle things on our own, we stop listening. We stop listening to everyone, which includes the Lord, and that spells trouble. You see, we live in times of rebellion. Rebellion against all authority. Children refuse to respect their parents. Workers refuse to respect their employers. Nations refuse to respect their world leaders, and judges refuse to respect the law and society overall. They've all come to believe that morals are no longer established by God. Instead, they believe that public and personal opinions determine everything. So in closing, last one. Parents, let's make sure we are training our children in the things of God. Let's teach them to read the Bible, to pray to God, and to seek him always. We've got to fight for our children and fight for their spiritual well-being. And to everyone here, let's make sure that God is priority in our lives. Let's make sure that we have everything in order. Place him above all. Let's respect those in authority over us. Let's submit to them. Let's follow his example and live a godly life. And let's build a right relationship with our Father in heaven. You see, life must be one priority. It must have one priority. That priority is God. Why? Because there is no greater thing than to know Jesus Christ. Amen.